and yet he still wanted more. They'd swum into the shallows to wash off the sand crusted on them, but Aelin had wrapped her legs around his waist, kissed his neck, then licked his ear the way he'd nibbled hers, and he was buried in her again. She knew why he needed the contact, why he'd needed to taste her on his tongue, and then with the rest of his body. She'd needed the same. He still needed it. When they'd finished after that first time, he'd been left reeling, to pull his sanity back together after the joining that had unleashed him, broken and remade him. His magic had been a song, and she had been... He'd never had anything like her. Everything he'd given her, she'd given right back to him. And when she had bit him during that second coupling in the sand, his magic had left 6 nearby palm trees in splinters as he'd climaxed hard enough that he thought his body would shatter. But once they were finished, when she'd actually made to walk back to Skull's Bay in nothing but her flames, he'd given her his shirt and belt, which did little to cover her up, especially those beautiful legs. But at least it was less likely to start a riot. Barely, though. And it'd be obvious what they'd done on that beach the moment they stepped within scenting range of anyone with a preternatural sense of smell. He'd marked her. Richer than the scent that had clung to her before. Marked her deep and true. And there was no undoing it. No washing it away. She'd claimed him, and he'd claimed her, and he knew she was well aware of what that claiming meant. Just as he knew it had been a choice on her part. A final decision regarding the matter of who would be in her royal bed. He would try to live up to that honor, try to find some way to prove he deserved it, that she hadn't bet on the wrong horse. Somehow, he'd earn it, even with so little to offer beyond his own magic and heart. But he also knew his queen, and knew that despite the enormity of what they'd done, Aelin had also kept him on that beach to avoid the others, avoid answering their questions and demands. But he made it 1 foot inside the Ocean Rose, saw the light in Adian's room, and knew their friends would not be so easily deterred. Indeed, Aelin was scowling up at the light, though worry quickly replaced it, as she remembered the shifter who had been so thoroughly unconscious. Her bare feet were silent on the stairs and hallway as she hurried for the room, not bothering to knock before flinging open the door. Rowan loosed a sharp breath, trying to draw up his magic to cool the fire still in his blood, to calm the instincts roaring and raging at him. Not to take her, but to eliminate any other threat. A dangerous time for any fae male, when they first took a lover. Worse when it meant something more. Dorian and Adian sat in the 2 armchairs before the darkened fireplace, arms crossed, and her cousin's face went pale with what might have been terror as he scented Aelin, the markings both seen and invisible on them. Lysandra sat in bed, face drawn but eyes narrowed at the queen. It was the shifter who purred, "Enjoy your ride." Adian didn't dare move, and was giving Dorian a warning look to do the same. Rowan bit down against the rage at the sight of other males near his queen, reminding himself that they were his friends. But that primal rage stumbled as he felt Aelin's shuddering relief upon finding the shifter mostly healed and lucid. But his queen only shrugged. "Isn't that all these fae males are good for?" Rowan raised his brows, chuckling as he debated reminding her how she'd begged him throughout, how she'd said words like "please" and "oh gods," and then a few extra pleases thrown in for good measure. He'd enjoy wringing those rarely seen manners from her again. Aelin shot him a glare, daring him to say it. And despite just having her, despite the fact that he could still taste her, Rowan knew that whenever they found their bed again, she would not get the rest she wanted. Color stained Aelin's cheeks, as if she saw his plans unfold. But she lifted the amulet from around her neck, dropped it onto the low-lying table between Adian and Dorian, and said, "I learned that this was the third word key when I was still in Wendlin." Silence. Then, as if she hadn't shattered any sense of safety they still possessed, Aelin withdrew the mangled eye of Elena from her pack, chucked it once in the air, and jerked her chin at the King of Otterlin. "I think it's time you met your ancestor." Dorian listened to Aelin's story, about the word key she'd secretly carried, about what had happened today in the bay, about how she'd tricked Lorkin and how it would eventually lead the warrior back to them, hopefully with the other two keys in his hands. And if they were lucky, they would have already found this lock she had been ordered twice now to retrieve from the stone marshes, the only thing capable of binding the word keys back into the gate from which they'd been hewn, and ending the threat of Erewhon forever. No number of allies would make a difference if they could not stop Erewhon from using those keys to unleash the Volg hordes from his own realm upon Irelia. His possession of two keys had already led to such darkness. If he gained the third, gained mastery over the word gate, and could open it to any world at will, use it to summon any conquering army. They had to find that lock to nullify those keys. When the queen was done, Adian was silently fuming, Lysandra was frowning, and Aelin was now snuffing out the candles in the room with hardly a wave of her hand. Two ancient tomes, withdrawn from Adian's crammed saddlebags, lay open on the table. He knew those books. He had no idea she'd taken them from Rifthold. The warped metal of the Eye of Elena amulet sat atop one of them, as Aelin double-checked the markings on an age-spotted page. Darkness fell, as she used her own blood to etch those markings on the wooden floor.
"Looks like our bill of damages to this city is going to rise," Lysandra muttered.
Aelin snorted. "We'll just move the rug to cover it." She finished making a mark. A word mark, Dorian realized with a chill, and stepped back, plucking up the eye in her fist.
"Now what?"
Adian said.
"Now we keep our mouths shut," Aelin said sweetly.
The moonlight spread on the floor, devoured by the dark lines she'd etched. Aelin drifted over to where Rowan sat on the edge of the bed, still shirtless thanks to the queen currently wearing his shirt, and took up a spot beside him, a hand on his knee. Lysandra was the first to notice. She sat up in the bed, green eyes glowing with animal brightness, as the moonlight on the blood mark seemed to shimmer. Aelin and Rowan jerked to their feet. Dorian just stared at the marks, at the moonlight, at the beam of it shining through the open balcony doors. As if the light itself were a doorway, the shaft of moonlight turned into a humanoid figure. It flickered, its form barely there, like a figment of a dream. The hair on Dorian's arms rose, and he had the good sense to slide out of his chair and onto a knee as he bowed his head. He was the only one who did so. The only one, he realized, who had spoken to Elena's mate, Gavin, long ago, another lifetime ago. He tried not to consider what it meant that he now carried Gavin's sword, Damaris. Aelin had not asked for it back, did not seem inclined to do so. A muffled female voice, as if it were calling from far away, flickered in and out with the image.
"Too far,"
a light young voice said. Aelin stepped forward and shut those ancient spellbooks before stacking them with a thump. "Well, Rifthold isn't exactly available, and your tomb is trashed, so tough luck." Dorian's head lifted as he glanced between the flickering figure of moonlight and the young queen of flesh and blood. Elena's roughly formed body vanished, then reappeared, as if the wind itself disturbed her.
Can't. Hold.
Then I'll make it quick. Aelin's voice was sharp as a blade. No more games. No more half-truths. Why did Deanna arrive today? I get it, finding the lock is important. But what is it? And tell me what she meant by calling me the queen who was promised. As if the words jolted the dead queen like lightning, his ancestor appeared, fully corporeal. She was exquisite. Her face young and grave, her hair long and silvery white, like Manon's, and her eyes, startling, dazzling blue. They now fixed on him, the pale gown she wore fluttering on a phantom breeze.
Rise, young king.
Aelin snorted. Can we not play the holier-than-thou ancient spirit game? But Elena surveyed Rowan, Adian. Her slender, fair neck bobbed. And Aelin, gods above, snapped her fingers at the queen. Once, twice, drawing her attention back to her. Hello, Elena, she drawled. So nice to see you. It's been a while. Care to answer some questions? Irritation flickered in the dead queen's eyes. But Elena's chin remained high, her slender shoulders back.
I do not have much time. The connection is too hard to maintain so far from Rifthold.
What a surprise. The two queens stared each other down. Elena, word damn him, broke first.
Deanna is a god. She does not have rules and morals and codes the way we do. Time does not exist for her the way it does for us. You let your magic touch the key. The key opened a door, and Deanna happened to be watching at that exact moment. That she spoke to you at all is a gift. That you managed to shove her out before she was ready. She will not soon forget that insult, Majesty.
She can get in line, Aelin said. Elena shook her head.
There is so much I did not get to tell you.
Like the fact that you and Gavin never killed Erewhon, lied to everyone about it, and then left him for us to deal with.
Dorian risked a glance at Adian, but his face was hard, calculating, ever the general,
fixed on the dead queen now standing in this room with them.
Lysandra was gone.
No, in ghost leopard form, slinking through the shadows. Rowan's hand was resting casually on his sword, though Dorian's own magic swept the room, and realized the weapon was to be the physical distraction from the magical blow he'd deal Elena, if she so much as looked funny at Aelin. Indeed, a hard shield of air now lay between the two queens, and sealed this room, too. Elena shook her head, her silver hair flowing.
You were meant to retrieve the word keys before Erewhon could get this far.
Well, I didn't, Aelin snapped. Forgive me if you weren't entirely clear on your directions.
Elena said, I do not have time to explain, but know it was the only choice. To save us. To save Irelia. It was the only choice I could make.
And for all their snapping at each other, the queen exposed her palms to Aelin.
Deanna and my father spoke true. I'd thought it was broken, but if they told you to find the lock...
She bit her lip. Aelin said, Brannan said to go to the stone marshes of Eelway to find the lock. Where, precisely, in the marshes?
There was once a great city in the heart of the marshes.
Elena breathed.
It is now half-drowned on the plain. In a temple at its center, we laid the remnants of the lock. I didn't... My father attained the lock at terrible cost. The cost of my mother's body, her mortal life. A lock for the word keys, to seal shut the gate, and bind the keys inside them forever. I did not understand what it had been intended for. My father never told me about any of it, until it was too late. All I knew was that the lock was only able to be used once. Its power capable of sealing anything we wished. So I stole it. I used it for myself, for my people. I have been paying for that crime since.
You used it to seal Erewhon in his tomb, Aelin said quietly. The pleading faded from Elena's face.
My friends died in the Valley of the Black Mountains that day, so I might have the chance to stop him. I heard their screaming, even in the heart of Erewhon's camp. I will not apologize for trying to end the slaughter so that the survivors could have a future. So you could have a future.
So you used the lock, then chucked it into a ruin?
We placed it inside the holy city on the plain to be a commemoration of the lives lost. But a great cataclysm rocked the land decades later, and the city sank. The marsh water flowed in, and the lock was forgotten. No one ever retrieved it. Its power had already been used. It was just a bit of metal and glass.
And now it's not?
If both my father and Deanna mentioned it, it must be vital in stopping Erewhon.
Forgive me if I do not trust the word of a goddess who tried to use me like a puppet to blow this town into smithereens.
Her methods are roundabout, but she likely meant you no harm.
Bullshit.
Elena flickered again. Get to the stone marshes. Find the lock.
I told Brannon, and I'll tell you, we have more pressing matters at hand.
My mother died to forge that lock,
Elena snapped, eyes blazing bright.
She let go of her mortal body so that she could forge the lock for my father. I was the one who broke the promise for how it was to be used.
Aelin blinked, and Dorian wondered if he should indeed be worried when even she was speechless. But Aelin only whispered,
"Who was your mother?"
Dorian ransacked his memory, all his history lessons on his royal house, but couldn't recall. Elena made a sound that might have been a sob, her image fading into cobwebs in moonlight.
She who loved my father best, she who blessed him with such mighty gifts, and then bound herself in a mortal body and offered him the gift of her heart.
Aelin's arms slackened at her sides. Adian blurted, "Shit." Elena laughed humorlessly as she said to Aelin,
"Why do you think you burn so brightly? It is not just Brannon's blood that is in your veins, but Mala's."
Aelin breathed.
"Mala Firebringer was your mother."
Elena was already gone. Adian said, "Honestly, it's a miracle you two didn't kill each other." Dorian didn't bother to correct him that it was technically impossible, given that one of them was already dead. Rather, he weighed all that the queen had said and demanded. Rowan, remaining silent, seemed to be doing the same. Lysandra sniffed around the blood marks, as if testing for whatever remnants of the ancient queen might be around. Aelin stared out the open balcony doors, eyes hooded, and mouth a tight line. She unfurled her fist and examined the eye of Elena, still held in her palm. The clock struck 1 in the morning. Slowly, Aelin turned to them. To him.
"Mala's blood flows in our veins,"
she said hoarsely. fingers closing around the eye before she slipped it into the shirt's pocket. He blinked, realizing that it indeed did. That perhaps both of them had been so considerably gifted because of it. Dorian said to Rowan, if only because he might have heard or witnessed something in all his travels,
"Is it truly possible for a god to become mortal like that?"
Rowan, who had been watching Aelin a bit warily, twisted to him.
"I've never heard of such a thing, but Fae have given up their immortality to bind their lives to that of their mortal mates."
Dorian had the distinct feeling Aelin was deliberately examining a spot on her shirt.
"It's certainly possible Mala found a way to do it."
"It's not just possible," Aelin murmured. "She did it. That pit of power I uncovered today, that was from Mala herself. Elena might be many things, but she wasn't lying about that." Lysandra shifted back into her human form, swaying enough that she set herself down on the bed before Adian could move to steady her.
"So, what do we do now?"
she asked, her voice gravelly.
"Erewhon's fleet squats in the Gulf of Oro. Maeve sails for Eelway. But neither knows that we possess this word key or that this lock exists, and lies directly between their forces."
For a heartbeat, Dorian felt like a useless fool as they all, including him, looked to Aelin. He was king of Otterlin, he reminded himself, equal to her. Even if his lands and people had been stolen, his capital captured. But Aelin rubbed her eyes with her thumb and forefinger, loosing a long breath.
"I really, really hate that old windbag."
She lifted her head, surveying them all, and said simply,
"We sail for the Stone Marshes in the morning, to hunt down that lock."
"Rolf and the Mycenaeans?" Adian asked.
"He takes half his fleet to find the rest of the Mycenaeans, wherever they're hiding. Then they all sail north to Terrasen."
"Rifthold lies between here and there, with wyverns patrolling it," Adian countered. "And this plan depends on if we can trust Rolf to actually follow through on his promise."
"Rolf knows how to stay out of range," Rowan said. "We have little choice but to trust him. And he honored the promise he made to Aelin regarding the slaves 2.5 years ago.
No doubt why Aelin had made him confirm it so thoroughly.
"And the other half of Rolf's fleet?" Adian pushed.
"Some remain to hold the archipelago," Aelin said. "And some come with us to Eelway."
"You can't fight Maeve's armada with a fraction of Rolf's fleet," Adian said, crossing his arms.
Dorian bit back his own agreement, leaving the general to it.
"Let alone Morath's forces."
"I'm not going there to pick a fight,"
was all Aelin said. And that was that. They dispersed then, Aelin and Rowan slipping off to their own room. Dorian lay awake, even when his companion's breathing became deep and slow. He mulled over each word Elena had uttered, mulled over that long-ago appearance of Gavin, who had awoken him to stop Aelin from opening that portal. Perhaps Gavin had done it not to spare Aelin from damnation, but to keep those waiting, cold-eyed gods from seizing her, as Deanna had today. He tucked the speculation away to consider when he was less prone to leaping to conclusions. But the threads lay in a lattice across his mind, in hues of red and green and gold and blue, glimmering and thrumming, whispering their secrets in languages not spoken in this world. An hour past dawn, they departed Skulls Bay on the swiftest ship Rolf could spare. Rolf didn't bother to say goodbye, already preoccupied with readying his fleet, before they sailed out of the sparkling harbor and into the lush archipelago beyond. He did grant Aelin one parting gift, vague coordinates for the lock. His map had found it, or rather the general location. Some sort of wards must be placed around it, the captain warned them, if his tattoo could not pinpoint its resting place. But it was better than nothing, Dorian supposed. Aelin had grumbled as much. Rowan circled high above in hawk form, scouting behind and ahead. Fenris and Gavriel were at the oars, helping row them out of the harbor, Adian doing so as well, at a comfortable distance from his father. Dorian himself stood at the wheel beside the surly short captain, an older woman who had no interest in speaking to him, king or not. Lysandra swam in the surf below in some form or another, guarding them from any threats beneath the surface. But Aelin stood alone on the prow, her golden hair unbound and flowing behind her, so still that she might have been the twin to the figurehead mere feet beneath. The rising sun cast her in shimmering gold, no hint of the moonfire that had threatened to destroy them all. But even as the queen stood undimming before the shadows of the world, a lick of cold traced the contours of Dorian's heart. And he wondered if Aelin was somehow watching the archipelago, and the seas, and the skies, as if she might never see them again. 3 days later, they were nearly out of the archipelago's strangling grasp. Dorian was again at the helm, Aelin at the prow, the others scattered on various rounds of scouting and resting. His magic felt it before he did. A sense of awareness, of warning and awakening. He scanned the horizon. The Fey warriors fell silent before the others. It looked like a cloud at first, a wind-tossed little cloud on the horizon. Then a large bird. When the sailors began rushing for their weapons, Dorian's mind at last spat out a name for the beast that swept toward them on shimmering, wide wings. Wyvern. There was only one, and only one rider atop it. A rider who did not move, whose white hair was unbound, listing toward the side, as the rider now was. The wyvern dropped lower, skimming over the water. Lysandra was instantly ready, waiting for the queen's order to shift into whatever form would fight it. No. The word ripped from Dorian's lips before he could think. But then it came out over and over as the wyvern and rider sailed closer to the ship. The witch was unconscious, her body leaning to the side because she was not awake, because that was blue blood all over her. Don't shoot! Don't shoot! Dorian was roaring the order as he hurtled for where Fenris had drawn his longbow, a black-tipped arrow aimed at the witch's exposed neck. His words were swallowed by the shouting of the sailors and their captain. Dorian's magic swelled as he unsheathed Damaris. But then Aelin's voice cut over the fray. Hold your fire! All of them halted. The wyvern sailed close, then banked, circling the boat. Blue blood crusted the beast's scarred sides. So much blood. The witch was barely in the saddle. Her tan face was leached of color, her lips paler than whalebone. The wyvern completed its circle, sweeping lower this time, readying to land as near the boat as possible. Not to attack, but for help. One moment. The wyvern was soaring smoothly over the cobalt waves. Then the witch listed so far that her body seemed to go boneless, as if in that heartbeat, when help was mere feet away. Whatever luck had kept her astride at last abandoned her. Silence fell on the ship, as Manon Blackbeak tumbled from her saddle, falling through wind and spindrift, and hit the water. Part 2. Fireheart. Chapter 40. The smoke had been stinging Olead's eyes for the better part of the gray, muggy morning. Just farmers burning fields left to fallow, Molly had claimed, so the ashes might fertilize the earth for next year's harvest. They had to be miles away, but the smoke and ash would travel far on the brisk northward wind. The wind that led home to Terrison. But they weren't headed to Terrison. They were headed due east, straight toward the coast. Soon she'd have to cut northward. They had passed through one town, only one, and its denizens had already been fatigued of roving carnivals and performers. Even with the night barely underway, Elite already knew they would likely only make enough money to cover their expenses for staying. She had attracted a grand total of 4 customers to her little tent so far, mostly young men looking to know which of the village girls fancied them, barely noticing that Elide, beneath the makeup pasted thick as cream on her face, was no older than they were. They'd scampered off when their friends had rushed by, whispering through the star-painted flaps that a swordsman was putting on the show of a lifetime, and his arms were nearly the size of tree trunks. Elide had glowered, both at the feckless young men who vanished, one without paying, and at Lorkin for stealing the show. She waited all of 2 minutes before shoving out of the tent, the enormous, ridiculous headdress Molly had plunked on her hair snagging on the flaps. Bits of dangling beads and charms hung from the arching crest, and Elide batted them out of her eyes, nearly tripping over her matching blood-red robes as she went to see what all the fuss was about. If the young men of the town had been impressed by Lorkin's muscles, it was nothing on what those muscles were doing to the young women. And older women, Elide realized, not bothering to squeeze through the tightly packed crowd before the makeshift stage on which Lorkin stood, juggling and throwing swords and knives. Lorkin was not a natural performer. No, he had the gall to actually look bored up there, bordering on outright sullen. But what he lacked in charm, he made up for with his shirtless, oiled body. And holy gods, Lorkin made the young men who had visited her tent look like children. He balanced and hurled his weapons as if they were nothing, and she had the feeling the warrior was merely going through one of his daily exercise routines. But the crowd still oohed and awed at every twist and toss and catch, and coins still trickled into the pan at the edge of the stage. With the torches around him, Lorkin's dark hair seemed to swallow the light, his onyx eyes flat and dull. Elide wondered if he was contemplating the murder of everyone drooling over him like dogs around a bone. She couldn't blame him. A trickle of sweat slid through the crisp spattering of dark hair on his sculpted chest. Elide watched, a bit transfixed, as that bead of sweat wended down the muscled grooves of his stomach. Lower. No better than those ogling women, she said to herself, about to head back into her tent, when Molly observed from beside her. Your husband could just be sitting up there, fixing your stockings, and women would empty their pockets for the chance to stare at him.
He had that effect wherever we went with our former carnival, Elide lied.
Molly clicked her tongue. You're lucky, she murmured, as Lorkin hurled his sword high in the air, and people gasped, that he still looks at you the way he does. Elide wondered if Lorkin would look at her at all if she told him what her name was, who she was, what she carried. He'd slept on the floor of the tent each night. Not that she'd ever once bothered to offer him the roll. He usually came in after she'd fallen asleep, and left before she awoke. To do what, she had no idea. Perhaps exercise, since his body was like that. Lorkin chucked 3 knives in the air, bowing without one bit of humility or amusement to the crowd. They gasped again as the blades aimed for his exposed spine. But in an easy, beautiful maneuver, Lorkin rolled,
catching each blade, one after another. The crowd cheered, and Lorcan coolly looked at his pan of coins. More copper and some silver flowed like the patter of rain. Molly let out a low laugh. Desire and fear can loosen any purse strings. A sharp glance. Shouldn't you be in your tent? Elide didn't bother responding as she left, and could have sworn she felt Lorcan's gaze narrow on her, on the headdress and swaying beads, on the long, voluminous robes. She kept going, and endured a few more young men and some young women asking about their love lives, before she found herself again alone in that silly tent, the dark only illuminated by dangling crystal orbs with tiny candles inside. She was waiting for Molly to finally shout the carnival was over, when Lorcan shouldered through the flaps, wiping his face with a scrap of fabric that was most definitely not his shirt. Elide said, "Molly will be begging you to stay, you realize." He slid into the folding chair before her round table.
"Is that your professional prediction?"
She swatted at a strand of beads that swayed into her eyes.
"Did you sell your shirt, too?"
Lorcan gave a feral grin.
"Got 10 coppers from a farmer's wife for it."
Elide scowled.
"That's disgusting."
"Money is money. I suppose you don't need to worry about it with all the gold you've got stashed."
Elide held his stare, not bothering to look pleasant.
"You're in a rare good mood."
"Having 2 women and 1 man offer a spot in their beds tonight will do that to a person."
"Then why are you here?"
It came out sharper than she intended. He surveyed the hanging orbs, the woven carpet, the black tablecloth, and then her hands, scarred and calloused and small, gripping the edge of the table.
"Wouldn't it ruin your ruse if I slipped off into the night with someone else? You'd be expected to throw me out on my ass, to be heartbroken and raging for the rest of your time here."
"You might as well enjoy yourself," she said. "You're going to leave soon anyway."
"So are you,"
he reminded her. Elide tapped a finger on the tablecloth, the rough fabric scratching against her skin.
"What is it?"
he demanded, as if it were an inconvenience to be polite.
"Nothing."
It wasn't nothing, though. She knew why she'd been delaying that turn northward. The inevitable departure from this group and final trek on her own. She could barely make an impact at a backwater carnival. What the hell would she do in a court of such powerful people, especially without being able to read? While Aelin could destroy kings and save cities, what the hell would she do to prove her worth? Wash their clothes? Clean their dishes?
"Marion,"
he said roughly. She looked up, surprised to find him still there. Lorcan's dark eyes were unreadable in the dimness.
"You had plenty of young men unable to stop staring at you tonight. Why not have some fun with them?"
"Why?"
she snapped. The thought of a stranger touching her, of some faceless, nameless man pawing at her in the dark. Lorcan stilled. He said too calmly,
"When you were in Morath, did someone..."
"No."
She knew what he meant.
"No, it didn't get that far."
But the memory of those men touching her, laughing at her nakedness, she shoved it away.
"I've never been with a man. Never had the chance or the interest."
He cocked his head, his dark silken hair sliding over his face.
"Do you prefer women?"
She blinked at him.
"No, I don't think so. I don't know what I prefer. Again, I've never had the opportunity to feel that."
Desire,
Lust. She didn't know. And she didn't know how or why they'd wound up talking about this.
Why?
And with all of Lorkin's considerable focus honed in on her, with the way he'd glanced at her red-painted mouth, Elide wanted to tell him about the tower and Vernon and her parents, about why, if she were ever to feel desire, it'd be a result of trusting someone so much that those horrors faded away. A result of knowing they would fight tooth and claw to keep her free, and never lock her up, or hurt her, or leave her. Elide opened her mouth. Then the screaming started. Lorkin didn't know why the hell he was in Marion's ridiculous little oracle's tent. He needed to wash, needed to clean away the sweat and oil, and feel of all those ogling eyes on him. But he'd spotted Marion in the crowd while he'd finished up his piss-poor performance. He hadn't seen her earlier in the evening before she'd put on that headdress and those robes, but maybe it was the cosmetics, the heavy coal around her eyes, the way the red-painted lips made her mouth look like a fresh piece of fruit. But he'd noticed her. Noticed the way the men had spotted her, too. Some had outright gawked, wonder and lust written across their bodies, as Marion lingered, oblivious, at the edge of the crowd, and watched Lorkin instead. Beautiful. After a few weeks of eating, of safety, the terrified, gaunt young woman had somehow gone from pretty to beautiful. He'd ended his performance sooner than he'd intended, and by the time he looked up again, Marion was gone. Like a god's damned dog, he'd picked up her scent among the crowd and followed her back to this tent. In the shadows and glowing lights within, with the headdress and dangling beads and dark red robes, the oracle incarnate, serene, exquisite, and utterly forbidden. And he'd been so focused on cursing himself for staring at that ripe, sinful mouth, while she admitted she was still untouched, that he hadn't detected anything amiss until the screaming started. No, he'd been too busy contemplating what sounds might come from that full mouth if he slowly, gently taught her the art of the bedroom. The attack, Lorkin supposed, was Hellas's way of telling him to keep his cock in his pants and mind out of the gutter.
"Get under a wagon and stay there," he snapped, before hurtling out of the tent.
He didn't wait to see if she obeyed. Marion was smart. She knew she'd stand a better chance at survival if she listened to him and found shelter. Lorkin loosed his gift through the panicking carnival sight, a wave of dark, terrible power sweeping out in a ripple, then rushing back to tell him what it sensed. His power was gleeful, breathless in a way he knew too well. Death. At one end of the field lay the outskirts of the little town. At the other, a copse of trees and endless night. And wings. Towering sinewy forms plunged down from the skies. His magic picked up four. Four Ilken as they landed, claws out and bearing those flesh-shredding teeth. The leathery wings, it seemed, marked them as some slight variation of the ones who had tracked them in Oakwald. A variation, or a refining of an already ruthless hunter. People ran, screaming, toward the town, toward the cover of the dark fields beyond. Those distant fires had not been set by farmers to burn their idle fields. They had been set to cloud the skies, to hide the scent of these beasts. From him, or any other gifted warriors. Marion. They were hunting Marion. The carnival was in chaos. The horses were shrieking and bucking. Lorkin plunged toward where the four Ilken had landed in the heart of the camp, right where he'd been performing minutes before, in time to see one land atop a fleeing young man and flip him onto his back. The young man was still screaming for gods who would not answer,
as the Ilkin leaned down, flicking free a long talon, and opened up his belly in a smooth swipe. He was still screaming when the Ilkin lowered his mutilated face and feasted.
"What in burning hell are those beasts?"
It was Ombriel, a longsword out, and gripped in a way that told him she knew how to wield it. Nick came thundering up behind her, two rough, near-rusted blades in his meaty hands.
"Soldiers from Morath," was all Lorkin supplied.
Nick was eyeing the blade and hatchet Lorkin had drawn, and he didn't think to pretend to not know how to use either, to be a simple man from the wilds, as he said with cold precision,
"They're naturally able to cut through most magic, and only beheading will keep them down."
"They're nearly 8 feet,"
Ombriel said, face pale. Lorkin left them to their assessments in fear, stepping into the ring of light in the heart of the camp, as the four Ilkin finished playing with the young man. The human was still alive, silently mouthing pleas for help. Lorkin lashed out with his power, and could have sworn the young man had gratitude in his eyes, as death kissed him in greeting. The Ilkin looked up as one, hissing softly. Blood slid from their teeth. Lorkin tunneled into his power, preparing to distract and addle them, if their resistance to magic held true. Perhaps Marion would have time to run. The Ilkin who had ripped open the belly of the young man said to him, laughter dancing on its gray tongue,
"Are you the one in charge?"
Lorkin simply said,
"Yes."
It told him enough. They did not know who he was, his role in Marion's escape. The four Ilkins smiled.
"We seek a girl. She murdered our kin, and several others."
They blamed her for the Ilkins' death those weeks ago? Or was it an excuse to further their own ends?
"We tracked her to the Acanthus Crossing. She may be hiding here, among your people."
A sneer. Lorkin willed Nick and Ombriel to keep their mouths shut. If they so much as started to reveal to them, the hatchet in his hands would move.
"Check another carnival. We've had this crew for months."
"She is small,"
it went on, those two human eyes flickering,
"crippled on one leg."
"We don't know anyone like that."
They'd hunt her to the ends of the earth.
"Then line up your crew, so we might inspect them."
"Make them walk. Look them over. Look for a dark-haired young woman with a limp and whatever other markers her uncle had provided."
"You've scared them all away. It might be days before they return."
"And again," Lorkin said, hatchet flicking a bit higher, "there is no one in my caravan who matches such a description." Behind him, Nick and Ombriel were silent, their terror a reek that shoved itself up his nose. Lorkin willed Marion to remain hidden. The Ilkin smiled, the most hideous smile Lorkin had beheld in all his centuries.
"We have gold."
Indeed, the Ilkin beside it had a hip pouch sagging with it.
"Her name is Elide Lochin. Her uncle is Lord of Paranth. He will reward you handsomely to turn her over."
The words hit Lorkin like stones. Marion,
Elide, had lied.
Had managed to keep him from even sniffing the lie on her. Had used enough truths and her own general fear to keep the scent of it hidden.
"We know no one by such a name," Lorkin said again.
"Pity," the sentinel crooned. "For if you had her in your company, we would have taken her and left. But now..."
The Ilkin smiled at its three companions, and their dark wings rustled,
Now, it seems we have flown a very long way for nothing. And we are very hungry.
Chapter 41. Elide had squeezed herself into a hidden floor compartment in the largest of the wagons and prayed that no one discovered her or began burning things. Her frantic breathing was the only sound. The air grew tight and hot. Her legs trembled and cramped from staying curled in a ball. But still she waited. Still she kept hidden. Lorkin had run out. He'd just run into the fray. She'd fled the tent in time to see four Ilken, winged Ilken, descend upon the camp. She had not lingered long enough to see what happened after. Time passed. Minutes, or perhaps hours, she couldn't tell. She had done this. She had brought these things here, to these people, to the caravan. The screaming grew louder, then faded, then nothing. Lorkin might be dead. Everyone might be dead. Her ears strained, and she tried to quiet her breathing to listen for any sounds of life, of action beyond her small, hot hiding space. No doubt it was usually reserved for smuggling contraband, not at all intended for a human being. She couldn't stay hidden much longer. If the Ilken slaughtered them all, they'd search for any survivors, could likely sniff her out. She would have to make a run for it, have to break out, observe what she could, and sprint for the dark fields and pray no others waited out there. Her feet and calves had gone numb minutes before, and now tingled incessantly. She might very well not even be able to walk, and her stupid, useless leg. She listened again, praying to Aneth to turn the Ilken's attention elsewhere. Only silence greeted her. No more screaming. Now. She should go now, while she had the cover of darkness. Elide did not give her fear another heartbeat to whisper its poison into her blood. She had survived Morath, survived weeks alone. She'd make it. She had to make it. And she wouldn't at all mind being the Queen's God's damned dishwasher, if it meant she could live. Elide uncoiled, shoulders aching as she quietly eased the trapdoor up, the little area rug sliding back. She scanned the interior of the wagon, the empty benches on either side, then studied the night beckoning beyond. Light spilled from the camp behind her, but ahead. A sea of blackness. The field was perhaps 30 feet away. Elide winced as the wood groaned, while she hefted the trapdoor high enough for her to slither belly down over the floorboards. But her robe snagged, yanking her into a stop. Elide gritted her teeth, tugging blindly, but it had caught inside the crawlspace. Aneth, save her.
Tell me, drawled a deep male voice behind her, from near the driver's seat. What would you have done if I were an Ilken soldier?
Relief turned her bones to liquid, and Elide held in her sob. She twisted to find Lorkin covered in black blood, sitting on the bench behind the driver's seat, legs spread before him. His axe and sword lay discarded behind him, coated in that black blood as well, and Lorkin idly chewed on a long stalk of wheat as he gazed at the canvas wall of the wagon.
The first thing I might have done in your place, Lorkin mused, still not looking at her, would have been to ditch the robe. You'd fall flat on your face if you ran, and the red would be as good as ringing the dinner bell.
She tugged at the robe again, and the fabric ripped at last. Scowling, she patted where it had come free, and found a loose bit of wood paneling.
The second thing I might have done, Lorkin went on,
not even bothering to wipe away the blood splattered on his face,
is tell me the God's damned truth.
Did you know those Ilken beasts love to talk with the right encouragement? And they told me some very, very interesting things.
Those dark eyes at last slid to her.
Utterly vicious. But you didn't tell me the truth.
Did you?
Elide.
Her eyes were wide. Her face leached of color beneath the cosmetics.
She'd lost the headdress somewhere,
and her dark sheet of hair slid free of some of its pins as she climbed from the hidden compartment.
Lorcan watched every movement, assessing and weighing and debating what exactly to do with her.
Liar. Cunning little liar. Elide Locken, rightful Lady of Peranth, crawled out, slamming the trap door shut and glaring at him from where she knelt on the floor. He glared right back.
"Why should I have trusted you?" she said with impressive coldness. "When you were stalking me for days in the forest. Why should I have told you a thing about me when you could have sold me to the highest bidder?"
His body ached. His head throbbed from the slaughter he'd barely managed to survive. The Ilken had gone down, but not willingly. And the one he'd kept alive, the one Nick and Ombriel had begged him to kill and be done with, had told him very little, actually. But Lorcan had decided his wife didn't need to know that. Decided it was time to see what she might reveal if he let some lies of his own fool her. Elide glanced at his weapons, at the reeking blood coating him like oil.
"You killed them all?"
He lowered the wheat stalk from his mouth.
"Do you think I'd be sitting here if I hadn't?"
Elide Locken wasn't some mere human trying to return to her homeland and serve her queen. She was a royal-blooded lady who wanted to get back to that fire-breathing bitch in the north to offer whatever aid she could. She and Aelin would be well-suited for each other, he decided. The sweet-faced liar and the insufferable, haughty princess. Elide slumped onto the bench, massaging her feet and calves.
"I'm risking my neck for you,"
he said too quietly.
"And yet you decided not to tell me that your uncle isn't just a mere commander at Morath, but Erewhon's right hand. And you are his prized possession."
"I told you enough of the truth. Who I am makes no difference, and I am no one's possession." His temper yanked at the leash he'd been careful to keep short before tracking her scent to this wagon. Outside, the others were hurriedly packing, readying to flee into the night before the villagers decided to blame them for the disaster.
"It does make a difference who you are. With your queen on the move, your uncle knows she'd pay a steep price to get you back. You are not a mere breeding asset. You are a negotiation tool. You might very well be what brings that bitch to her knees."
Rage flashed in her fine-boned face.
"You keep plenty of secrets too, Lorcan."
She spat his name like a curse.
"And I still haven't been able to decide if I find it insulting or amusing that you think I'm too stupid to notice. That you thought I was some fear-addled girl, too grateful for the presence of such a strong, brooding warrior to even question why you were there, or what you wanted, or what your stake in all this is. I gave you exactly what you wanted to see. A lost young woman in need of help. Perhaps a bit skilled at lying and deceit, but ultimately not worth more than a few seconds' consideration. And you, in all your immortal arrogance, didn't think twice. Why should you, when humans are so useless? Why should you even bother, when you planned to abandon me the moment you got what you needed?"
Lorcan blinked, bracing his feet on the floor. She didn't back down an inch. He couldn't remember the last time anyone had spoken to him like that.
"I would be careful what you say to me."
Elide gave him a hateful little smile.
Or what? You'll sell me to Morath? Use me as your